Last week, we broke down Max Seacrest's argument to the Court of Appeals, claiming that Sandy Melgar's jury voted to convict her of murder without legally sufficient evidence. The insufficiency argument was cited as point of error number one in the appeal brief. As a quick recap, Max's contention is that the entirety of the evidence presented by the prosecution at trial did not meet the legal standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the verdict was based on speculation and probability rather than a factual analysis of the evidence. As I stated last week, I believe that Seacrest's claim was all but proven by the jury foreman, who has gone on record to say that the verdict was based on his assessment that the prosecutor's theory made the most sense. But moving past that argument, in today's episode, we're going to be discussing point of error number two from the appellate brief.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In the appeal brief, point of error number two is stated as follows. Reversible error was committed by the prosecutor improperly injecting the religious tenets of the Jehovah's Witness religion into the trial of this case and the cross-examination of defense witness Rocio Reeb, and in final argument, in violation of the First Amendment and due process clauses of the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution, the Due Course of Law Clause of the Texas Constitution, and Texas Rule of Evidence 610. As stated, Seacrest's claim is based largely on the cross-examination of Rocio Reeb, who you heard on our show last month. As you'll remember, Rocio was very close friends with both Jim and Sandy. While I was on the phone with Rocio, she talked a little bit about her treatment while on the witness stand at trial. She was exasperated by what she referred to as bullying by the prosecutor. Rocio told me that Barnett was only interested in attacking her religion while she was on the stand. I read the first sentence of the restatement of point of error number two in the brief. It reads as follows. The prosecutor's tact in cross-examining Rocio Reeb was to slime her religion and that of the Melgars. Before we get any further into Max's argument in the appeal, I first want to go back to the trial and see what actually occurred during Rocio's testimony. She was called as a defense witness, so Allison Seacrest, Max's niece, was the first to question her. The purpose of putting Rocio on the stand was as a character witness for Sandy, and also to speak to the relationship between Sandy and Jim. I don't think anyone was expecting any fireworks out of her testimony, but things definitely took an ugly turn once Burnett began asking questions. During direct examination, Allison has Rocio tell the jury a little bit about herself. She's a retired teacher from Mexico City and has lived in Houston for about 35 years. She's married to a chemical engineer and has one son and one grandchild. Then Allison goes on to ask Rocio about a relationship with Sandy. They met in 1984 and have been very close friends for over 30 years. She also testified that she'd known Jim for a long time. She describes Jim as a gentleman, from the transcript. He was very much a gentleman. I think in Spanish, I apologize. He was kind and always opened the doors for the ladies. So he was very courteous, very aware of everything, helpful, really helpful. Next, Allison asks Rocio about Sandy. This is basically the entire purpose of her testimony. She's a character witness. Her job is to inform the jurors about who Sandy is as a person and also what her relationship with Jim was like. From the transcript. Allison Seacrest. And what kind of person is Sandy Melgar? Rocio. Oh, she's very, very nice. Very smart, too. Very kind. She will do anything for you. She's a hard worker. She would never complain about anything, even if she is in tremendous pain or suffering. She would not complain. She always looks for the good in others before she does for herself. So far, so good. And as I said, this is about what you would expect to hear from just about any character witness. The defense will call someone to tell the jury that the defendant is a good person. And actually, in a lot of the transcripts that I've read, the prosecutor doesn't even bother to cross-examine these types of witnesses. It's kind of pointless. Character witnesses aren't usually all that effective. I personally don't believe that most jurors are swayed by the fact that a friend or a family member of the defendant says that they're an upstanding citizen. Cross-examination will just put more attention on the witness, and it's not at all likely that they will reverse their position. Usually it's best to just let it go and let the evidence speak for itself. Of course, that wasn't the case in Sandy's trial, but we'll get to cross-examination in a little bit. Up to this point, in a matter of minutes, Rocio has told the jury that Jim and Sandy were both wonderful people and they had a great relationship. Allison then moves on to Sandy's medical issues. Since Sandy didn't take the stand, Allison used Rocio to explain not only her physical limitations, but also the fickle nature of her illnesses. From the transcript. Were there times she wasn't feeling very well? Rocio. Oh yeah, many, many times. We would try to make plans to get together for service or for coffee or whatever, and she would cancel because the lupus was acting up and her joints were very inflamed, and she couldn't move very well and she would stay in bed. She was extremely tired and she would take long naps. Question. Do you know if she had to take a lot of medications? Answer. I know she had to take medications, yes. Question. Do you know if it's because she had rheumatoid arthritis pain medications? Answer. Yes. Question. Have you seen Sandy have to take the medications? Yes. In fact, have you ever had to give her Tylenol, Advil, or other pain medications? Yes. Do you know if she was prescribed prescription pain medications? Yes. Have you ever seen Sandy have a seizure? No. Did you ever hear about Sandy having any seizures? Yes. And this is where Barnett jumps in and correctly objects that this is hearsay. From here, it's a lot of back and forth. Rocio is trying to explain how Sandy is affected by her medical conditions. Most of her responses call for hearsay. Barnett objects, and Allison rephrases the question. Rocio does manage to give us some valuable insight, however, into how Sandy's seizures, auras, and lupus affect her memory and ability to carry on a conversation. Remember, when Sandy was interviewing with the police on the night Jim's body was discovered, she had missed doses of her anti-seizure medications. Now, if you believe Sandy's guilty, then she hadn't had a pill since at least 4 p.m. that day. Or even earlier, depending on how long before the Melgars arrived, you believe that she tied herself up and locked herself in the closet. She was being interviewed into the early morning hours of Monday, so if she didn't stage the crime scene and actually was locked in the closet since the night before, it had been well over 24 hours since Sandy had had any of her medications when she went into that interrogation room. No anti-seizure meds, no lupus meds, nothing for arthritis or joint pain. She would have been dehydrated and had nothing to eat in over 24 hours. Think about how that might affect a person who has just experienced an extremely traumatic event and was in a room trying to explain her every movement for around 6 hours. And yeah, you heard me right, 6 hours. You see, Sandy wasn't just questioned for the 2 hours that we have recorded. This is what she had to say about her interrogation when I spoke to her last week. I know what, there was something missing from the tape?
A couple of hours missing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you think they, because they, we have an hour where they interviewed you, then you left the room to go talk to a polygraph examiner, and then you came back and there was another hour. You think there was something besides that?
At the end. The end is, because I kept asking for an attorney, and those are the parts that are missing. I didn't get home until about 3:30 or 4 in the morning. So if you calculate from, what, 9? About 9:30 to 3:30?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, you know.
Yeah, that's longer than 2 hours that the interview shows.
Exactly.
Okay, so then, so because it looked like there was, what's on the tape, the ending of what we have in the second portion was when you finally said they were, you know, you guys are torturing me, I'm done, I want a lawyer.
Yeah.
And they stopped and left the room. So did they come back in after that?
Yeah, they came back at least 3 more times after that. And each time I would ask for a lawyer, but each time, and then they got like rougher and more aggressive and even said, okay, we're booking you right now. And I said, okay, just do it so I can call a lawyer. And they'd go back out and then they'd come back in. And, at one point they asked me what size of, jumper I wore. And I just said, I don't care what size, just book me already so I can call a lawyer. And they went back out. And then they came back in and they said, well, we're taking you back to the house to take more photos and then we're booking you.
Wow.
So, they took me back home, and I seriously thought they were going to arrest me, but they just took pictures and left me.
We already knew that Harris County detectives tried to file charges against Sandy on that very night, before the crime scene investigators had finished processing the scene. But I guess I had never put two and two together to realize that if Carrizal and Doucet were still at the station going back and forth with the DA, then Sandy was also still at the station, sitting in that interrogation room. Here's the exchange from trial where Allison is asking Rocio about how Sandy's condition affects her memory. Question: have you ever been around Sandy when she was complaining of having auras? Yes. What is that? Well, she was beginning to start feeling really dizzy, lightheaded, and very confused. Her speech patterns began to change, her voice slows down, and at that time she'll either, if we're on the phone, she'll say, I have to go, I don't feel well, I can't, she can't make a sentence. And I knew that she said, I feel it's an aura, and I hung up and called Jim, and Jim will come over. Seacrest: and would that affect her memory? Rocio: yes. And how so? And at this point, Barnett objects again because of hearsay, and Allison restructures the question. Have you personally seen Sandy have any problems with forgetfulness or lack of memory? Yes. How so? For example, if we make plans for something and I will ask her, remember to bring whatever to the party, she said, oh, I completely forgot. I'm so sorry. I forgot. I'll go get it. I just forgot, or... And Barnett jumps in again to object. Again, hearsay. If we assume that Sandy is in fact telling the truth, and she was simply a second victim in this horrible crime and did not kill her husband, by the time she stepped into that interrogation room, it had been at least 24 hours since she had had a dose of her anti-seizure meds. She had had very little, if any, water, and most definitely no food. So if she seemed a little out of it, or off during the interrogation, it was for a very good reason. According to Rocio, Sandy suffered from memory loss, confusion, dizziness, and a host of other issues on occasion, even when she was taking her meds. So think about these two scenarios for a minute. How would you expect a person to carry themselves in the interrogation if they had brilliantly planned to murder their husband, executed that plan, then skillfully staged the scene to look like a home invasion and cleaned every drop of blood off of themselves? This person then has the presence of mind, physical, and mental ability to barricade themselves into a closet, and then tie their own ankles up, as well as their arms behind their back, and just to add to the effect, soil their underwear. Or then there's this scenario number two. A 53-year-old woman with epilepsy, lupus, and hip replacements gets hit on the head around midnight. That triggers a seizure. She's then tied up and barricaded into a closet where she's stuck for 15 hours. When she gets out, she's soiled herself, she's dehydrated and malnourished. Then she finds her husband of 32 years murdered, sits in a police car for 3 hours, and after 24 hours with no medications, she begins trying to answer the detective's questions. How would you expect that woman to handle the interrogation? Well, I can tell you what I would expect, and that is exactly what we see in Sandy Melgar's interview. The next topic in Rocio's direct examination is money. She testified that Sandy always had cash on her and rarely used anything else to make most purchases. In fact, she says she's only ever seen her use a card one time, and that was to purchase a dress for a wedding. And this becomes relevant, of course, because Sandy's wallet was found open and out of place at the crime scene, on the bed along with Jim's wallet, and there was no money found anywhere at the scene. On a previous episode, we discussed the probability of Jim having cash in his wallet. My opinion on the matter was that he likely did not have any, and that was based on the fact that he used his debit card to make a purchase of less than $5 at the CVS on their way home. But Sandy didn't go into the CVS that night, and according to Rocio, Sandy always did carry cash. Perhaps an indication that there was cash stolen out of her wallet on the night that Jim was killed. Rocio continued on to explain that Sandy is not at all a material person. She's never been motivated by money, from the transcript. She never really cared to go shopping for dresses or jewelry, or she never spoke about doing such things. She never wears anything on her person extravagant. Her house, she had a beautiful home, but she never looked for extravagant things in her house. Her cars were regular cars. She made sure she had a car to get there, and that was it. And I say, let's go shopping, let's go get this. And she would say, not really, I really don't have the desire. Look at the big picture with Sandy. With Jim's income, the rental properties, the medical billing company, and their investments, the Melgars had plenty of money. They were extremely comfortable, to say the least. Then couple that with the fact that Sandy used Goodwill pillow shams as bath rugs, and then jump back into the life insurance discussion from last week. Sandy Melgar was never motivated by money for anything. Direct examination continues with Rocio describing Sandy as always being calm and peaceful, never displaying any anger, even when she would encounter rude and nasty people during their door-to-door ministries. She explains that she has never seen anything between Jim and Sandy but love and respect, and that she has zero doubt that Sandy is innocent. And then from there, we jump back around to Sandy's medical issues. As I'm sure you recall from listening to Marissa, Monica, and Gerson's police interviews, the fact that Sandy was walking with a cane on the night she was found in the closet was of great concern to the police. The officers were able to obtain statements from several people that had actually never seen her walk with one. The implication, of course, being that she was faking her frailness. Getting past the obvious issue with this train of logic, why would someone who never needs a cane own a cane, and the fact that at that point Sandy had been without her pain and anti-inflammatory medications for 24 hours, the issue was addressed in Rocio's testimony. From the transcript. Question. Are you aware of times when Sandy's lupus was particularly bad and other times it was particularly better than others? Answer. During the cold season, during the winter, it's hard for someone with lupus and the winters are very hard for her. Her joints hurt more with the change of the weather. When she was very active, when we were together, I observed her stay away from the sun because if she would get too much sun, her joints would start to hurt, and she would start getting tired. Question, have you ever seen Sandy use a cane before? Answer, yes. And were there times, like as in this photograph, that you don't see a cane? Answer, no, you don't see a cane, but she had a cane during that time. Direct examination comes to an abrupt stop on Friday afternoon, right in the middle of Rocio's testimony, because one of the jurors had to catch a flight to Guatemala for the weekend. This particular juror actually received permission from the judge to travel to Guatemala on more than one occasion throughout the trial. Direct then picks back up on Monday, with Rocio explaining that as soon as she saw Sandy after the incident, she noticed that she had a black eye and a bump on the right side of her head. And aside from that, she described Sandy as being extremely pale and constantly shaking and sobbing. Rocio is the one that finally took Sandy to the doctor on the 27th. And that's the report that I read you a few weeks ago, the one that cited the hematoma on Sandy's head, the bruised eye, and diagnosed her with PTSD. And that concluded Rocio's direct examination. As a character witness, she did a great job. As a longtime friend of Jim and Sandy's, Rocio was able to give the jury some insight into Sandy's personality, her character, and her relationship with her husband. She also presented some new evidence to the jury in the way of the fact that Sandy had a history of memory problems, complications with her illness and medications, and the fact that Sandy seemed to always carry cash. All in all, Rocio's testimony wasn't groundbreaking, but it did add some necessary insight into who Sandy was as a person and her habits. Everything was going fine until Barnett stepped up for cross-examination. And that's where Max Seacrest says she violated Sandy's constitutional rights. It's during Rocio's cross-examination that Max Seacrest believes Sandy's constitutional right to a fair trial was violated. Direct examination consisted of a lot of background into Sandy's character. But during cross, Barnett's focus wasn't on Sandy at all. It was on her religious beliefs. Max believes the purpose of this line of questioning was to elicit disdain for Sandy from the jurors due to her religion. You can decide for yourself if you believe that to be accurate. There's just no way that I can do this testimony justice by simply summarizing it. While I usually prefer to not read documents in their entirety directly to you, I think that that's the only way for you to get the full picture in this instance. If I had more time and a team of voice actors, I would love to have two women reading these parts, But all things being as they are, you get me, playing the parts of both Colleen Barnett and Rocio Reeb. So here we go. It takes Barnett all of 3 questions before she shifts the focus onto the Jehovah's Witnesses. From the transcript.
You met them in church?
Yes.
And do you remember how old they were when they got married?
No.
Okay, and you're a Jehovah's Witness, is that right?
Correct.
And do you normally socialize with people that are also Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yes.
And can you tell us how, do they go to church every week?
Yes, they would go to church as a congregation, and we go, if you want, twice a week, 2 hours during the week, and 2 hours on Sunday.
Okay, and did they do that?
Yes.
Were Sandy and Jamie devout Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he was an elder, which was a high position.
A high position. And you mentioned something last week that I didn't really catch, that she was not able to do something because of her illness. Was there something you said?
Well, she wanted to be out and go out with us to go door to door. That's what we do to teach people the Bible.
What is that called, the name for that?
We call it in-service ministry.
And that's when people go door to door and try to convert people.
We don't convert people. We ask them if they want to know more about the Bible.
I see. And is that something you do on a regular basis?
Yes, ma'am.
And some people that are devout Jehovah's Witnesses do that on a regular basis?
Correct.
And so would you say that you and the Melgars were devout enough that you really believed everything that Jehovah's Witnesses teach?
Correct.
So divorce is looked upon poorly?
Correct.
If you don't mind, let me finish my question. In fact, it's not allowed, right?
It is allowed. The Bible says that it is allowed if one of the spouses commits adultery.
And you don't think Jim would have done that, right?
No.
So if Sandy was unhappy in her marriage, she just has to stick it out, right?
No. To the best of my knowledge, every time I saw her...
That's not my question, ma'am.
Okay, no. If she was unhappy, if I should mention... If she was unhappy, we have what we call elders. We have a support group. They're helped through the Bible, and they can get counsel through the Bible as to help themselves from what the problem is.
Right, and that really wasn't my question. My question is that you can't get divorced because the church will, A, not allow you to remarry, right?
They will allow you to remarry if there's adultery and physical abuse.
Listen to my question, ma'am. We've already established that if there is adultery in the marriage, that you are right to get divorced in most cases with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Correct.
And I believe you testified that you don't think that Jamie Melgar was cheating on his wife.
No.
And it doesn't seem like anybody was thinking that, right?
No.
So if she wanted to get a divorce because she was unhappy in her marriage, then A, the elders wouldn't approve it, and B, if she got divorced, she's not allowed, according to Jehovah's Witnesses, to remarry. Isn't that right?
No, it's not.
Okay, so according to 1 Timothy 3:1, 5, and 12, quote, someone who chooses to divorce without scriptural grounds is not scripturally free to remarry, end quote. That's not what Jehovah's Witnesses believe?
Yes, they...
Thank you, ma'am. And also, you're not allowed to celebrate birthdays, are you?
Correct, we're not.
So if there was testimony earlier that she and Jamie were celebrating a birthday, would that be against the church values?
That is left to their conscience.
But the church doesn't allow it, right?
No.
And that's also why we don't see any Christmas decorations in the house, because Jehovah's Witnesses don't respect or acknowledge Christmas, right?
Can you rephrase that question again, please?
Yes, I can. In fact, give me just a second here.
It's at this point that things really start to go off the rails, right after a short break. I'm about to get back into the transcript, but before I do, keep in mind that Texas has been referred to by many as the, quote, buckle of the Bible Belt. So think about how the following line of questioning might be received by a Texas jury. Keeping in mind that the entire point and principle behind Texas Rule of Evidence number 610, the rule cited in Mac's brief, is to, quote, guard against any prejudice which may result from a disclosure of a witness's faith, end quote. Now, back to the transcript. Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate Christmas, right?
Right.
You don't celebrate New Year's Eve?
Right.
Don't celebrate Easter?
Yes.
Don't celebrate Mother's Day?
Correct.
Don't celebrate Father's Day?
Correct.
Don't celebrate birthdays?
Correct.
Thanksgiving?
Correct.
Flag Day?
Excuse me?
Flag Day.
Yes, we do.
You do celebrate Flag Day?
No, we don't.
Independence Day?
No.
St. Patrick's Day?
No.
Valentine's Day?
No.
Halloween?
No.
Hanukkah?
No.
None of those things?
No.
You also can't say anything negative about the organization, right?
Give me a second, because it's not a black and white question.
Well, Jehovah's Witnesses must speak in agreement and be like-minded, correct?
Correct.
You're not allowed to have best friends and activity buddies who are not Jehovah's Witnesses. That's true, right?
Yes.
And you're not allowed to live in a house of someone of the opposite sex unless you're married to them, right?
And Mac jumps in here. Your Honor, I'm going to object to relevance. And why it's relevant, I'm not sure. Barnett.
It's establishing a mindset of the defendant for one of the reasons why she did what she did.
Mac again. Objection to speech by counsel, that she, quote, did what she did. That's why we're here. There's no evidence. The judge. Overruled. Back to Barnett.
You're not allowed to live in a house with someone of the opposite sex unless you're married to them, right?
Right.
And you can't live in a house with someone that you're divorced from, true?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yes, you can't live in a house with someone that you're divorced from.
Correct.
What does it mean that you shall not eat foods that contain blood or its primary components? Is that meat?
What it means is, for example...
Is it meat, ma'am?
Mac jumps to Rocio's defense. Your Honor, I'm going to object. She's asking a question and not being given the opportunity to properly answer the question. She's cutting her off. The judge, please let her answer before you ask your next question. And now back to Barnett.
You can't attend Alcoholics Anonymous, right?
I'm sorry, that question I truthfully don't know.
You cannot donate to any religious organizations other than Jehovah's Witnesses.
Correct.
You can't join the Boy Scouts.
Correct.
You can't join the Girl Scouts.
Correct.
You can't determine, elders are the only ones who can determine if a member is unrepentant, right?
Yes.
Elders shall disfellowship anyone who breaks the rules, is that true?
It is true, but you need to know more about the Bible before the questions are asked. It's not black and white.
Of course, and that's why elders determine that, don't they?
No, the elders get together, they pray, they talk to the person. It's a whole lot of investigation, and they notice if the person's heart condition is correct, if it's right. At the end, the person makes that decision and gives repentance. And yes, they get disfellowship or disassociated from the congregation for a period of time, but they are allowed to come back.
Disassociate from the congregation? What does that mean?
That means that they can come to the congregation, but we're not, as a congregation, allowed to talk to them because they did something wrong. They did something against the Bible.
So if somebody breaks a rule and they're disassociated from the congregation, that means that their friends cannot talk to them, right?
We can talk to them brief and encourage them to come back, yes, but we're not allowed to associate with them in parties or associate more than just encouraging them to come back and say, I'm glad you're here.
Which would be a lot different from the type of relationship that you have with the Melgars today, right? Or her, anyway.
Well, yeah. Rephrase that question again?
Yeah, y'all are close friends, aren't you?
Correct, yes.
You've been close friends for a long time?
Correct.
You're friends with the family for a long time?
Correct.
So she did something that the elders proclaimed, that she should be disassociated from the organization. You wouldn't be able to maintain a friendship with her, would you?
No, that's a close relationship as I have. I'll see her in the congregation, and I will encourage her to keep coming, and that's about it.
This next little exchange is a little confusing. Barnett is giving an example, and Rocio thinks she's talking to her. Back to the transcript.
Thank you for being here. Hope you're doing okay.
Thank you.
All right, so you also believe that the dead are in a state of unconsciousness, right?
Mac jumps in again. Your Honor, again, I'm going to object. I don't understand how all of this is relevant. The judge, come on up. This next part is from a bench conference. Barnett.
Motive for what she did, ostracized from her church to prove and establish she killed her husband and make it seem like somebody else did. In fact, if she divorced her husband and is allowed back or disassociated, they don't allow divorce. So it goes to death as the motive as to why she killed him.
The judge, I'll give you a little leeway. And now back into cross.
Jehovah's Witnesses believe that the dead are in a state of unconsciousness, right?
Correct, we can believe that.
And you don't believe that the soul survives death, is that right?
Please repeat the question again.
Do you believe... Let me move on. Do you believe that only 144,000... Is that 144,000?
Correct.
Only 144,000 will go to heaven?
Correct, that's what Revelation says in the Bible.
And that's from the beginning of time, and those people are chosen, and nobody knows who they are, right?
No. I mean, except for themselves.
They know it?
Uh-uh.
When they're walking around, they know they're the ones?
Uh-huh.
Do they not tell anybody, or do they keep it a secret?
No, we celebrate once a year the death of Christ, and we celebrate the dead because he asked us to commemorate his death, which is more important because he died for all of us and our sin. And when we do that, they're the ones that partake of the wine and the bread.
So it's possible that Jamie Melgar could have been one of those 144,000 that went straight to heaven.
I don't know that. Only Jehovah God knows that.
So the answer to my question is, no, you don't know.
No, I don't know.
Is it true that Jehovah's Witnesses shall not lie, but can refrain from telling the truth to those that Jehovah's Witnesses deem don't deserve it?
No, that's not true.
That is not true?
We are always. Can I just tell you something? The Bible says always tell the truth.
Well, it's so strange that in here, on the issue of morality, it says, you shall not lie, but you may refrain from telling the truth to those Jehovah's Witnesses deemed do not deserve it.
And if you would allow me to explain, that will be clear.
I think it's clear.
Mac again. Your Honor, I object. May the witness answer the question? She cut her off. The judge. Please wait and do not talk over each other. It's hard for the court reporter. Seacrest. Your Honor, I ask that the witness be allowed to answer the prosecutor's questions. Judge. Okay, ask your question. Barnett.
She answered it.
And back to Cross.
And you can't vote, right?
Right.
You can't pledge allegiance to your country or a flag.
Correct.
And you can't report for jury duty.
Yes, we can report for jury duty, and if you allow me to tell you something, because I think that your question is very good, but it also doesn't lead to a complete answer.
And ma'am, I'm sure you're going to be asked those questions again, but I guess that maybe you can report to be a juror, but you can't be a juror.
No, we can be a juror. I've been a juror before.
Oh, you have?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'll pass the witness.
Did Colleen Barnett use Rocio Reeve as a tool to turn the jury against Sandra Melgar? In my opinion, she absolutely did. You'll have to judge for yourself. Through Rocio's cross-examination, this Texas jury was informed that Sandy doesn't pledge allegiance to the flag or to the United States. She doesn't celebrate the birth of Christ or his resurrection. And in a state with a population of 28.3 million, mostly Christian people, the jurors heard that Sandy believes that only 144,000 will make it into heaven. Barnett stopped just short of telling the jurors that Sandy hates football. Max Seacrest makes the following argument to the Court of Appeals in the brief. In the present case, the very purpose of Rule 610, quote, to guard against any prejudice which may result from a disclosure of a witness's faith, end quote, was eviscerated. Surely the actual purpose for engaging in such questioning was to ostracize adherents of the Jehovah's Witnesses religion, Sandra Melgar and other members of the Jehovah's Witnesses who supported her, from the jury and to improperly attack the credibility of Ms. Reeve based on her religious convictions. It was nothing less than a base appeal to religious prejudice which has no place in the trial of a criminal case and served to egregiously prejudice Sandra Melgar. Ultimately, it's going to be up to the Court of Appeals to decide if the insertion of Sandy's religion, through Rocio's testimony, prejudiced the jury enough to convict her of murder without evidence. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Mike Bussing is our executive producer and Shane Yoder is our sound engineer. All music for the show was created, composed, and scored by PutThemInASong.com, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Our Season 6 logo was also created by Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com. Our banner images and type font across all of our logos was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of createdintandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Britta Bliss, Sarah Colby, Rachel Timberman, and Liz Rose. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $1 per month, and we also have reward levels on the Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. But the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter. The show's handle is @TruthJusticePod, and my personal Twitter handle is @BobRuffTruth. And for more personal interactions, feel free to follow me on Instagram @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.